I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for March 7th, 2017. Members of the committee, so today we're going to be discussing the budget information about early learning, and I encourage you to ask whatever questions that you have going along. I appreciate and understand.
Why is Mr. Wilson leaving?
Why is he leaving,
You mentioned budget, and he
he's
leaves
to leave. And again, I appreciate we're not the budget committee, but obviously policy has impacts on what the budget ends up being or not, then we may be making some recommendations that would impact the budget. So I think it's just important for all of us to have some background on that. So I'm going to open an informational hearing on the budget and outcomes. And so David, our favorite presenter, is here. And I know, so we have others that are here to be able to answer questions, and maybe Doug. I don't know if Doug wants to come up, or Doug, do you just want to wait until we ask questions, or how would you like to?
I think I'll take your resource.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Maybe that.
Welcome.
Chair Lively, committee members, for the record, David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director. Chair Lively had asked me to walk the committee through some of the more information about the Early Learning Division's budget, both at our operational level and at our program level, and also talk about metrics for the division as a whole, but also where appropriate for particular programs.
Trying to switch to OLIS.
Sure. I didn't bother you, did it, David?
Sure you were. Just wanted to see if you all were paying attention.
Much of what I'll be sharing with this committee today is also information and, in fact, slides that I shared last week and this week with the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. I thought I would start off today, though, a little bit with some of our agency key performance measures. These are the legislatively adopted key performance measures. I think these give us sort of a high-level look at some of what we're trying to track in terms of achieving our goals. As you've heard me talk a lot in previous discussions, and I apologize that today I'm going to have to go back over some air ground that I think we've covered before, but also, as is so often with this committee, really appreciate the opportunity for conversation. So also, please feel free, as I know you guys do, to interrupt me at any point to ask questions. But in terms of part of our goals, both through the programs that we directly administer, but also through the private and nonprofit childcare programs that we oversee and regulate, one of our goals has been to increase the number of children that are in quality early learning settings. One key piece of that has been the Spark QIS initiative. And so one of our key KPM is to look at the number of programs that have engaged in the Spark process. So these are the programs that, to use the language, have either been rated or have shown a commitment to quality by engaging in the process. So I think that's just, so this is in some sense also a measure of engagement with that process. And you can see that at this point we have we've seen some really substantial increases in that.
So David, so once a program has achieved that rating, so then it's just a matter of reconfirming at different times that they're still there. I mean, so those numbers aren't counted again.
So these programs may not have yet, most of these programs have not yet achieved a rating yet.
Okay.
I think one of the goals of Spark and all the work that we do is not simply to rate programs, it's really to provide pathways and supports to engaging in practices that improve quality. So, but that first step is for a program to say, this is something I want to engage in. I want to do the self-assessment. I want to work with a quality improvement specialist.
Sure.
And what we see is sort of our second KPM is really a dramatic increase in the number of programs that have received a Spark rating of 3, 4, or 5. Again, Spark is still pretty new, so we look forward to really seeing dramatic increases to continue. Again, this was really work that the Race to the Top grant made possible, but work that will also continue that we're really excited to be able to support past the end of Race to the Top. As we always talk about our three goals, children arriving at school ready to succeed, children living in healthy, stable, attached families, and early learning system that's aligned, coordinated, aligned, family-centered. So the Oregon's kindergarten assessment, which is really about 4 years old at this point, really provides an important snapshot in looking at that question of, are we making progress in the percentage of children who are demonstrating some of those key skills, both sort of pre-academic skills, literacy and math, but also those really key social and behavioral skills that we know are so crucial for later academic success. Part of the reason that the kindergarten assessment is really so important for early learning is that, one of the things I've sort of talked about, unlike K through 12 for early learning, this is really our first opportunity where we know where most of the children are at one time. So it really provides one of the few sort of population level snapshots that we have of how our children are doing. But also as a population level snapshot, and also given what percentage of children either our official early learning programs or the work of the hubs actually connects, this is really a long-term goal. It's really exciting to see some of these numbers moving in the right direction over the last few years. These are so far pretty small increases, but to be honest, I think given where we are in the early learning work, this is the kind of pattern I think we'd be hoping to be seeing at this point in time.
So, David, is there a standard? So, the standard from the standpoint when the tests are given and when that information is available to the kindergarten teachers, so that information can be used during that year.
Chair Lively, committee members, this is a really great and important question. There are some guidelines on for the timing window for when the assessment can be administered. To be honest, I'd have to get back to you with the exact schedule. But the goal is to have it not so late in the year that you're sort of measuring what's already happened during kindergarten, but not so early that kids haven't had, any chance to acclimate to the experience, and particularly for the measures of social-emotional development and approaches to learning, which are really teacher observation. It's also really important that the teachers have had enough time with the children. So those timelines are based on that balancing act. On to your second question on the timeliness of getting the information to teachers. To be honest, this has been a real question and a challenge. Mm-hmm. The kindergarten assessment, when it was first instituted 4 years ago, was really pretty. So part of the goal was to, include this as part of the assessments that ODE as a whole administers, that are administered in the same way across the state. And it was really quite a new, different kind of assessment, but it also used the existing ODE framework. And part of that included sort of rules about test privacy. Mm. So, for instance, on I'll just make up something, a 12th grade math test, you don't really want the exact questions in the field so that students would be studying and knowing the answers to those particular questions. For these kinds of questions, like letters of the alphabet and sound, and also really the questions for approaches to learning that teachers are asking, not only is it probably a little bit silly to hide the alphabet, but we also really want parents and preschool teachers and communities to know what this is about, so it's not mysterious. Sorry, this is, I'm actually getting to your answer. So some of those original security frameworks that were in place for all of ODE's assessments made it very challenging for the department to get some of the information back to teachers in a timely fashion. Last year, the department and we were part of these discussions, made the kindergarten assessment a non-secured assessment. Mm-hmm. I just want to emphasize, the data is all completely secure, but what is not secure is the questions that kindergarten teachers are being asked to observe about a child's behavior, or the questions about the alphabet or early math that are being asked. And then I think that's really important, both in trying to get the information to teachers in a timely fashion. But we also don't want this to be a source of either anxiety or suspicion among communities. So I think it's also really important to now have that opportunity to share that information more widely. So sorry, that was probably a long answer to what was a short question.
Thank you.
You know, and then finally, you know, this is really one of the department's KPMs, but I think it's really important for us as the Early Learning Division to also be keeping our eyes on third grade assessments, because, you know, that's ultimately our goal, is to put children on a trajectory of success. So I think it's really important to make sure that we're looking at that and thinking about those linkages and what that means. Now to the exciting budget numbers.
Yes.
So I'm going to return to the individual programs, but I just wanted to walk this committee a little bit more detail through our overall budget. So what this chart looks at our 2015-17 legislatively approved budget. So the Early Learning Division's total budget was about $400 million. 58% of that, $233 million, is general fund. And most of that is grant and aid that goes directly to programs into the community to pay for services. So it's sort of not the, you know, there's not, in some sense, you could think of this, I don't know if this is a good or bad analogy, you know, a lot of, it's sort of in some sense equivalent to the state school fund. You know, most of what we do is grant out to OPK programs, healthy family organs programs, early learning hubs, funding. And, you know, what's also part of this, and this is part of the way that state accounting works, part of that grant and aid is also the close to $100 million that we transfer to DHS for employment-related daycare. About 39% of this is federal funds, the vast majority of which is from the Child Care Development Fund, the federal block grant for child care subsidies and support to the child care system. You know, and it's something you'll continually hear me say, without the CCDF, there really would not be a child care system in the state. It's really what pays for not only most of the direct subsidies to families, but most of the work both in forms of regulatory and support for child care. The 2015-17 legislatively approved budget, our federal funds also included about $12 million in Race to the Top funding. As I mentioned, that expired, that grant expired in December. You'll see a little bit of we received a no-cost extension, so you'll see a little bit of those federal funds in our CSL budget for the next biennium, but that's largely going away. And then finally, we have about $13.5 million in other funds. Most of that is federal funds that other agencies receive and transfer to us. So, you know, you can think of it as sort of the other side, you know, so our $100 million that comes in grant and aid of ERDC is then other funds for DHS, and similarly, there's some Medicaid match that goes along with Healthy Families Oregon, some Title for to be family support dollars that the Department of Human Services transfers to us that we then transfer to hubs and some other programs that go along with the goals of that federal grant. And then there is just a little bit of licensing fees, fines, and also the childcare contribution tax credit receipts that are part of this other funds. So any questions? And this is just the another way of looking at the legislatively approved budget at a program level. Again, you'll see that of the $233 million from the legislatively approved budget that we receive in general funds, $224 of that is grants that go directly out to programs, with about $8.7 million for operations. And similarly, you'll see most of our federal funds go also out in grants. But you also see that they make up the better part of our operational budget. And that's really because of that regulatory function of the Office of Child Care. So just another way of looking at it, this is actually based on current service level rather than legislatively approved budget. Actually, that actually doesn't quite look right to me, but it's about 7% so operating. And this is just a look at our projected federal resources for 2017-19. And again, 98% of that's the Federal Child Care Development Fund, that Child Care Block Grant, with a little bit of race to the top for that no-cost extension I mentioned. And then you'll see that we receive, and every state receives this, a little bit of money, about $200,000, for the position of the Head Start Collaboration Director. Because in most, we actually have a uniquely close relationship between our Oregon pre-kindergarten program and the federal Head Start program. And because the federal Head Start program is a federal to local program that doesn't at all pass through states, I think they created this position to help make sure that there were sort of more linkages between that federal and state work. It's a little bit different story in Oregon, just because of the way that Oregon pre-kindergarten works and the kind of collaboration that means with the federal Head Start program.
So we know that the Child Care Development Block Grant from the feds for 2017 to 2019 is indeed that amount of money?
No, this is projected.
So help me understand. So their fiscal year is different than ours.
Yes.
So when do they set the amount?
Chair Lively, committee members, let me get back to you with the exact same timeline on those federal budget cycles. So I think we have more certainty for the first year of the biennium than the second year of the biennium. Chair.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Okay. Thank you. Forgive me if I missed this detail. What department do the federal funds come out of?
They come out of Health and Human Services.
Okay. And are we, as Oregon, at risk for any, I don't know, adjustments? You can answer me later.
I'll give you the answer. The answer. Chair Lively, Representative Bynum. I think at this point, just very little. I've heard very little detail on anticipation of changes in funding. I think one thing we can say is the CCDF was reauthorized in 2014. It took Congress 20 years to be able to reauthorize that legislation, which gives me some confidence that they're probably not, that Congress probably won't reopen that in the near future, given how that it took 2 days to get that through and that they've just promulgated the rules. So I think there may be uncertainty on the funding. I haven't heard anything to suggest that at least at the congressionally mandated statute and the rules that were just promulgated for CCDF would change in the near future.
Thank you.
And again, this is just another look at CCDF. You can see 77% we're projecting for direct subsidies. Again, most of that is ERDC. There's a little bit of what we call special population programs that are administered directly by the Early Learning Division that are part of that. Those include some funds that go to programs based in high school for teen parents, seasonal migrant, and a program currently for supporting drug and alcohol, child care programs and drug and alcohol programs. But as you can see, about 14% goes for the regulatory function of child care licensing. So it's a modest proportion of our overall CCDF, but almost all of what actually goes into supporting that work. And some of that also goes into the quality supports, and that includes things like our system of child care resource and referral networks that are located across the state that actually work directly with communities and providers to make sure that trainings are available, that providers have access to the trainings that they need to, you know, in accordance with the child care licensing rules, but also other opportunities for professional development and growth.
Have we talked about before what it costs a child care provider to license in the state of Oregon?
We haven't. And again, it's one of those pieces that varies by facility type. So it's a little bit different for a center than it would be for a registered family versus a certified family. I believe the base cost, which is the highest for a center for the initial, is $100 plus I think $2 per child. I will get back to you with those correct numbers. Okay. Just to give you one sense of what that means, our total other funds portion that includes all of the licensing fees and also all the fines that we collect is about $900,000 for a full biennium.
Really? Okay.
So it's not a huge amount of money. And also to put in a little bit of perspective, what we're projecting on the increase in the direct cost to providers of the new background and fingerprinting check requirements is more like $2.9 million for a biennium. So that's actually going to be a much more substantial cost than the fee that we collect for licensing, which is pretty nominal.
Representative Bynum.
Okay, thank you again. On the licensing question, licensing and background check, if I'm guessing the average wage is about, I don't know, $13 an hour, I'm just guessing, for a provider, 13 to 15. Is that licensing and background check, which I'm assuming now is going to be portable instead of belonging to the center, is that in line with what, say, like a nurse would have to pay for his or her license or some other professional? And is it disproportionate or proportionate to their income, and have we thought about that?
Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, this is sort of two pieces of that. One is the licensing fees, and those are substantially lower for like a registered family child care provider, and I can provide those information. The other more challenging issue is the direct cost of the fingerprint and background checks. Previously to the reauthorization of CCDF, the only individuals who were required to do the full FBI background check were individuals who had only recently moved to the state. So it was a fairly small portion of that. And the one thing I should also add in terms of these costs is it's not just for like a family child care provider. The background checks also apply to other adults in the household who may have unsupervised contact with children. The new CCDF rules are requiring that everyone receives the full CCDF, the full FBI fingerprint background check. So one way to put it is that our continued receipt of that $140 million per biennium is now contingent on us implementing these new rules. That the previous cost for a provider of the background check was about $3 for individual. It is going up to closer to $90 per individual. So it is a real serious cost, and I do believe it is a real burden on families. What we were able to do, not every state always draws down every single part of its CCDF fund, and when that happens, we sometimes get a little bit of a bonus CCDF check. So we received a couple $100,000 last fall that we're using to subsidize the fingerprint background checks between now and June. So it's around $45, which is still a really substantial burden. It's better than 90, but it's still a substantial burden. To be honest, unless there are other funds available, this is the change that's going to happen in July. So what we did put into our budget is another funds request to be able to collect that 2.9. And just to give a little bit more additional background on that, those are really expenses that go to things like the people who actually do the FBI background check. And there's a number of steps. So what we do is we collect those funds so that we can pay all those people along who are part of that process, so that's at least a little bit easier for the provider.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Lively. David, can you go to the, I think it's slide 14, it's children served. And I'm kind of looking at that up against all your dollar amounts. I just need to have some help kind of deciphering.
Yeah,
return on investment somewhat. So OPK includes, so the 146.9 million includes what portion? I just want to make sure I'm counting everybody. So the 13,706.
So 8,000 of that is OPK, 8,400 of that is OPK funded. And the remainder is federally funded.
So 8,000 8,000 children are served through OPK. So out of the 146.9, there's 8,000?
About 8,400, I believe, is that number.
Okay. So that's worse than I thought. Then healthy families.
So it comes out, if you do the math, to about $8,900 per child per year for OPK.
So 146.9 million, if you have 8,400, is more than that. Because at the 13,706, it was 10,007. So is there something else maybe out of that 146.9 that I'm missing that should be included in the OPK?
There's a little bit of the early Head Start funding for those
slots. The 2,339.
Are you looking at, which budget are you looking at?
Is that your breakdown?
Is that the legislatively approved or?
I am looking at 7. Yeah, the legislatively approved budget.
So you're looking at the $146 million general fund.
Yeah.
Is that what you're looking at?
The totals, yeah.
Yeah. It should be about 8,400, if I'm remembering correctly, is state funded.
Mm-hmm. And then I took the general fund, what it was that we were investing,
yeah,
to look at the return on investment in each one of these.
233 or 400?
So the 146.9 was the OPK side, and there's 8,400 served by that.
Yeah, and I actually do have some slides later on that have cost per child in them.
Okay, for each one of the programs?
Yes, I think I have it for each of the programs.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So that
well,
is
that might I might be ahead of myself.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I will wait until you get to those slides. Thank you.
And now back to the very beginning. Okay. Yeah. So I'll skip ahead. Just, you know, this is a little bit of our. This just gives you a sense of our operations side, for the program team that supports all of the programs that we administer. That's about 14 individuals. But as you'll see, most of our staff is in the Office of Child Care. So that's 88 of our staff are located. 45 of these 88 are located in communities across the state. So we have 8 field offices, include places like Milton Friedwater, Medford, Redmond, and the Dalles, where the folks who actually go into programs and do that child care licensing are located. The rest of that is also part of the central office that takes care of addressing complaints and compliance issues and administering background checks. Just to give you a little bit of sense of the scale on the background checks, it's about 28,000 background checks that they handle a year. So it's not a small body of work, that piece.
Once a person has a background check and they pass, that's good as long as they're... They don't have to do that every year, do they?
It's not a Chair Lively committee. It's not done every year. There is an expiration on it.
Okay.
And actually, this is something that you will... This committee will have a... more of an opportunity to talk about. The state rules require every 2 years. The new federal rules require every 5 years.
Oh.
So one of the agency bills related to being in compliance with the CCF rules is to ask the legislature to grant Early Learning Council rulemaking authority to determine the appropriate time period, and that was in the spirit of if federal rules change, that we don't need to come back and visit you to have that conversation again.
Okay, thank you.
This is just another look at our staffing, but I think this is actually a really important one. As you can see from this pie chart, 68% of our FTE is federally funded, really that's CCDF funding. And that our general funding counts for just over a quarter of our staffing.
So the question always is, David, if we weren't spending all that money on staff, could that money be spent on direct pay programs? So if weren't spending that money on staff, could those funds be spent on program, more students served?
If you go back to this, you'll see that the operational part of our budget from general funds is...
I'm talking about the federal funds. So that large group that's paid for by federal funds, so the 68%. So since those are federal funds, are those federal funds, do they come in for support or do they come in for the program, and that's how much it costs us to administer the program?
Chair Lively, committee members, the answer is both. So the CCDF requires that at least 70% of the funds be used for direct subsidies for families. But there's also a number of requirements that go along with it, including, I think, some ones that I think members of this committee, I'm sure, would also think are important, that there be some kind of health and safety, consumer protection for parents who are sending their children to child care. Sure. So.
No, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And as when I get to talking about the governor's requested budget and the fund shift, you'll see that basically we're not able to meet the new federal requirements without reducing the amount that's going to employment-related daycare for families.
Okay. Thank you.
So this is just a quick little cheat sheet of number of children served in different programs. To be honest, this one's a little bit confusing because, as Representative Hack already pointed out, for the OPK Head Start, that includes both the federal and the state together. For early Head Start, that's almost all federal. Only 64 of those slots, of those children, families are state funded. Just wanted to go through it program by program. So for Healthy Families Oregon, again, this is our statewide Healthy Families America accredited home visiting program, mostly serving infants and toddlers and expectant mothers. Annual cost for families about $5,900, currently serving about 2,460. In addition to the state federal funds, there's a little bit of Medicaid administrative claiming, and then also local match that's part of that.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So, David, can you clarify? It looked to me like the portion that comes out of the general fund is $24 million.
Yeah.
And if we have 2,460 families, that's $9,756 annual cost per family. So is there something I'm...
So if you do, I think, when I was actually looking at the numbers, you know, $29 million over 2 divided by 24,600.
Well, I'm just looking at what we have coming out of just the general fund.
And that's the biennial budget.
That's the biennial
for the 2 years.
Okay, that's why we have you here.
Okay, and that may be the same story on the OPK numbers.
I'll look.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
I was actually just checking my math on that one earlier.
I was looking at it going, this can't be right. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Can you just because I'm really familiar with Healthy Families, but I want you to describe a little more about this 25% local match requirement.
Chair Lively, Representative Malmstrom, to be honest, I would probably need to get back to from staff a little bit more details on that match. I do realize we have heard that it's been a little bit of a challenge, and I think there's been some discussion. Are there opportunities to have a broader in-kind definition as part of that? So,
and you're talking about required match, because, like, I know Multnomah County, for example, put a lot of general fund money into the program as well, but it wasn't mandated to do that. So I'm just kind of curious about what that's about.
If I'm remembering this correctly, that is part of the current rule requirements. So it's currently written into rule.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We've had a longstanding evaluation of Healthy Families Oregon, which has, I think, documented some of the important positive benefits that the program continues to make. Looking at a comparison population of similar children who did not receive services, children served by Healthy Families Oregon are 2.5 times less likely to be maltreated. Participating mothers were 13 percentage points more likely to read to their babies on a daily basis, and we know that's not only is that an important activity unto in itself, it's also, I think, a really important gauge of that key parent-child interaction that really is the focus of this program.
Yes, Senator Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair Lovely. I just want to add in, besides these bullet points, there's many other great, statistics about things like, that the children don't, turn into juvenile crime, that the people, finish their high school education. There's this whole long list of, indicators, and that they do really well. These are just ones he put in there because it's too long to go on. But there's just glowing information from this program. And then there's the national accreditation that goes with this as well. It's a big honor to do this and have been involved with this. So, yeah, I can't say enough good things.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, Representative Malmstrom, thank you for that. And that's correct. I think these were from the Oregon evaluation, and I think they were really just intended to give you a little bit of a sample of the breadth of outcomes associated with Healthy Families Oregon. And it's important to note, as Representative Malmstrom noted, that Healthy Families Oregon is Healthy Families America accredited. When the federal government created a federal funding stream for home visiting programs, They part of their requirement was that it would be a very small list of programs with very strong evidence based behind that, and Healthy Families America was part of that relatively small list, which I think gives you just a sign, which I think is just another more information on the importance of that accreditation.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Just curious on those comparisons, is that, we don't have to get into too much detail here, but I'm just curious, is that to a national general population of this age range, Oregon general population, or comparing to other children that could have been qualified for these programs, but there wasn't funding for it?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. This was part of an evaluation of Oregon evaluation of Healthy Families. It's been ongoing for quite a while. Because of the structure of Healthy Families Oregon, for the most part, you couldn't do a randomized control, where, you know, of saying you're an eligible family but you don't get it because we want to track the outcomes. So this was done on a matching basis of children and families with similar characteristics. So it wasn't. I can give you more detail on that. There has been a follow-up with HFO that was and the research should be coming out on this pretty soon, where they were able to do something more like a randomized control.
Yeah, it'd be interesting reading, but probably too in-depth for.
Representative Hack?
Thank you, Chair Lively. I just want to commend the work of this, looking at this and really digging into it, the impact on a family. We're not talking about just an individual child. We're talking about the family, and the return on investment is amazing. This is probably one of our lowest cost programs, yet the impact is phenomenal. So I think that was an eye-opener for me. I didn't realize that the cost was as minimal. I mean, in all honesty, with the number of families served, it's an entire family for that amount of an investment is...
Chair Lively, Representative Hack, and I think it's also just worth pointing out, when you look at the programs that we directly administer, they lean a little bit towards 3 and 4 year olds. So this is really one of our core set of services for expectant mothers and infants and toddlers. I think one of the really great things about this program, I mean, I think the strength of early learning programs in general is that they put families front and center. But this is really, its goal is to work directly with that dyadic unit of the mother and child.
Can I follow up? Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you pointed out another really good point. It's, one, meeting them where they are. Two, it's that young family. And if we're going to make a change that's a lifelong change, it's catching them while we're here, that's the early years. And so it's the birth and now the 3 and 4. So this was great news. Mm-hmm. I think this is awesome.
Representative Mostrom.
Yes, I could go on with singing the praises like Representative Hack. Another thing that I think is worth mentioning, it doesn't really show up in statistics, but it also leverages so many other community resources. The people that go out and make these home visits, are constantly referring to things in the community that also help them that they wouldn't otherwise know about. So it's really well spent dollars in this program.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks.
So again, Early Head Start. Early Head Start is the federal companion to Head Start. So its focus, again, is on expectant mothers, children up to the age of 3. And what's interesting about Early Head Start is it really has 3 models to it. There's a center-based model, a home-based model, and a mixed model, and programs have flexibility to choose the model based on community needs. But that being said, it is actually really the only center-based option that we have for infants and toddlers in terms of the purely publicly funded programs. Like Head Start, the focus income eligibility is families living under the federal poverty line. Given the size of that population and the resources available, I believe we're serving closer between the federal and the state investment 6 to 7% of that eligible population. So really to be enrolled in early Head Start, given the scale of the population and the need, there's usually other identified family stress factors that need to be identified.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Lively. David, in looking at what we're spending for the preschool promise versus the cost for early Head Start, I know the criteria for the preschool promise as far as who we're employing, what we're paying them is greater than early Head Start folks, yet the cost for enrollment in early Head Start is quite a bit greater than the average cost per enrollment slot in the promise program. Why is that?
Representative Lively, Chair Lively, Representative Hack. That is really being driven by the child to adult ratio. So when you're talking about working with a group of infants, you know, that's more of the 4 to 1 than 10 to 1. So even with the higher salary, once you get down to that low ratio, and, you know, exactly. If anyone had a baby, you know, the way those ratios really are really important. So that's really the main cost driver for early Head Start. I should mention that early Head Start is also one of the evidence-based programs that Oregon chose as part of its McVee funding, that federal funding stream. So here's similar numbers for OPK. About $8,900 is the average state per child cost. The federal cost is about $10,600. As I mentioned earlier, and I think I've talked to the committee a little bit about this, Oregon has a unique model for OPK. We basically, when OPK was created, I believe in 1988, basically said in statute, we will follow the federal Head Start performance standards. And follow means not also just the rules. When those rules change, we also move with those changes. And we are unique in the country of having that model. What that means is that, you know, of our OPK grantees, all but 7 of them are also federal Head Start grantees. So at a classroom level, you can't say that this child in a lot of these programs is a federally funded child and this child is a state-funded child. We are sort of perpetually playing a little bit of catch-up with the state per child cost and the federal per child cost. I think it's been well over a decade that we've sort of remained behind, and they move forward a little bit, and we move forward a little bit. And that's something that we need to watch as part of that arrangement. We have an additional challenge that's going to be starting to take effect over the next 2 years. Like CCDF, Head Start was fairly recently, well, actually it wasn't reauthorized, but the rule, there were new Head Start performance standards created. And there is a move by the federal program to move Head Start to be a full-day program. So currently it's both federal Head Start and OPK are funded as half-day programs. How this transition is going to happen, we're sort of learning as it evolves. There was a commitment by the feds to move all Head Start programs to full day by 2021, with a proviso that funding would go along with that. So who knows what that actually means. But 15 of our programs have received duration grants from the federal government for at least some of their classrooms to move towards a full-day program. So there's sort of two questions that are now on the table for us as a state with OPK. I think it's also important to remember, you know, this is our largest state general fund investment in early learning. So out of that 233 in general fund, about 146 of this from our legislatively approved budget. But so two things. So one, those changes also are now changes for Oregon. And two, to make this work at a classroom level, you can't have some funding that's for half a day and some funding that's for full day. So, you know, as I said, how this is actually going to play out and what the timing of the transition of the federal dollars is going to be is something that we're sort of watching and trying to, you know, we're beginning to have these conversations with the Head Start directors and the Head Start Association. But I do think it means that we need to figure out over the next 2 years, you know, if a program has all of its federal dollars extended to full day, how do we convert our Part A funding to full day funding? So it means two things. That means for some of these programs, that per child cost may dramatically change. It's because, and I'll look, we'll see this in the next slides, because a lot of the funding is for comprehensive services and for other reasons, you know, it wouldn't be a doubling, but it would be a significant increase to make that change. And just to give you a little bit of sense of the scale of what we've seen from the federal duration grants, as I said, the average federal cost is about $10,000 per child. For the programs that in Oregon that received a duration grant, it was on average, they were all over the place, about $5,000 per child. So
that was additional money.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the reality, Chair Lively Committee, I think the reality of the situation is if we ended up at current service level or some other level, what we may have to do is some kind of conversion where you would see potentially fewer children served for the same amount. So this is just to give you a little bit of a sense of how OPK programs use their resources. This is not a state mandate, this breakdown, so we grant them the funds and they need to work within the Head Start performance standards and they make decisions at the local program level on how to budget. So this is in some sense a back mapping by looking at their budgets on how the funds are spent, but I think it was important to give you a sense that, you know, about 47% is for the direct classroom and 17% is for the comprehensive services, and this has really been a traditional strength of the Head Start model, that focus on family engagement, on home visits, and on connecting families to comprehensive services. And just to give you some of the outcomes, most of our programs use TS Gold as part of a sort of ongoing monitoring of child development, and they do a fall three times a year assessment, and TS Gold allows the teacher to be able to sort of benchmark some of those skills on national norms. And what we've seen is about 92% using that measure of OPK children closing the achievement gap in literacy, 83% closed achievement gap in mathematics by spring. Oh. And it would be helpful if I could figure out the right direction to go. So that's just another version of that. So Preschool Promise, first year, As we shared this information a little bit with you. This is all, at this point, general fund dollars. This gives you a little bit of sense of the differences in per child cost by program type. Again, since we are about 5 months into this program, I don't really have child outcomes to share with you at this point in Preschool Promise, but hopefully when I come back to you, you know, we come back next fall, we'll have some information on that to share with you. And then relief nurseries. Again, combination of state general funds, a little bit of federal funding. By statute, there's a 25% required local match. In reality, it's much more like 50%. They are really raising about half of their money from local communities. So in some sense, it's, you know, one way to think about relief nurseries, it's a little bit of a public-private partnership, that model. The Relief Nursery Association has developed a funding formula that we've been working with on how the state dollars are allocated to relief nurseries, and that's that information at the bottom of the slide, again, which is trying to balance that need for base operations with the number of children served. And then finally in hubs, and I'm not going to talk about hub metrics today since we had a fair amount of time to talk about that. But this just gives you a breakdown of the actual hub funding. Again, there's a little bit of combination of general fund and some federal fund that gets passed to us as other fund. By statute, hubs are limited to no more than 15% of their funds being used for administrative overhead. This is actually a more stringent requirement than it may even sound at first blush, because this requirement passes on to all of the subcontracts. So this is not just a cap on, you know, on the hub coordination dollars, not all of which are really administrative. Administrative has a slightly tighter use. But if you are another entity receiving KPI funds, that requirement of no more than those public dollars that are being passed on to you by the hub, no more than 15% of those can also go to administrative overhead. And there's actually a somewhat complicated statutory definition of administrative overhead. Finally, I would like to share with you what's in the governor's requested budget. I realize that for this body, this is simply a recommendation, but I do think it just an opportunity to sort of talk about both some of the opportunities and needs. The governor's requested budget maintains all programs at current service level. For the most part, that's very similar to legislatively approved budget. The one place where there's a real exception to that is Preschool Promise. Since Preschool Promise was launched during the second year of biennium, so the $7.5 million paid for 1 year of services, the CSL for that is more like $35 million, since we're now talking about 2 years of services rather than 1 year of services. You will also see some significant increases in federal funds as part of our operations budget. Part of that is what I've been talking about in terms of these new CCDF rule changes. In order to be meeting those new requirements on on-site health and safety monitoring, but particularly also those 28,000 background checks that are now going from a more simple process to the FBI, full FBI background check. We did a little bit of sort of time testing, and that's really a change of 10 minutes to 40 minutes. You multiply that by 28,000, you can really see that's a very substantial increase in workload associated with that. And then we've also, as part of the governor's requested budget, so that $6.1 million I want to emphasize is, from the budget's perspective, is really budget neutral. That's really shifting federal funds that were part of our grant budget to federal funds that are part of our operations budget. But it does have an impact on employment-related daycare. It comes to about 349 families that would lose access as part of that change. And, you know, I point that out as someone who's a really true, strong believer in employment-related daycare. But again, those are what we need to continue to receive that $140 million biennium. That's really the bulk of that funding for employment-related daycare. In order to do those background checks, we're also asking for an increase in $2.9 million in other funds. It's just the ability to collect those fees for the background check.
So we had the question about the cost to the providers, but that $2.9 million is only the increased cost to run the program?
That's the cost to providers. Because that's money we collect from providers, we need authority from you to collect it. So that's why that comes into our budget as another funds request, part of the budget.
So it's not money to underwrite their cost?
No. It's to literally just be able to collect that $90 from them that we need to process those background checks based on the new rules.
Sure.
There's also $1.7 million general fund to do a little bit of backfilling on staffing. So we had originally, through Race to the Top, about 17 or 19, I should check my notes on this, limited duration positions that were part of that. Last legislative session, 2015-2017, seven of those were made permanent positions and funded one quarter with GF. So part of this $1.7 million is those positions that were already made permanent, making them fully general fund funded. So I know that's a little bit of a confusing story. And then the other part of this budget, of the governor's requested budget, is an $8 million recommendation to support the early learning workforce, both to strengthen those community-based coaching opportunities and to strengthen some of that work to help providers navigate community colleges and degree programs.
Questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I entertained a meeting in my office, and I don't exactly remember who I talked to, but there was this idea that we were pulling money from our, say, 16 to 24-year-old youth and transferring that money to investments in early childhood. Can you talk to that as we try to weigh where the money is going and who we're helping and at what time?
Chair Lively, Representative Bynum. If we talk about the governor's requested budget, so the only new investments of general fund really are the $8 million. There's a little bit of CSL roll up in there and the $1.7 million. To be honest, I can't quite speak to how the legislature is sort of seeing the choices it's making between investments and funding. I think, you know, the way that I've been trying to talk about these investments, and I know, you know, when we did our full education continuum, to really thinking about all of the investments across the educational continuum as working together. I know the legislature has some really hard choices to make, but from where I sit, I don't really see that as a trade-off between 16-year-olds and 3-year-olds or 24-year-olds or 12-year-olds.
That may have to do with the governor's recommended budget in certain areas. That's Doug shaking his head, I have a sense. So in the whole area, as far as education, there's certainly some areas in the recommended budget that didn't receive an increase or was held at current levels, where this particular case, there is an increase, but that doesn't necessarily reflect the fact that that's why the decision was made, but I'm sure that's what they were talking about. Is that right, Doug? Other questions? I mean, it's very difficult because, again, as you know, here's a specific, and I think we all understand and know the value of the investments early. Here's a specific from the standpoint of what the governor recommended, that we'd make some additional investments, and I think we're going to get to talk about even more additional investments we think would be important. But in a budget environment where there isn't enough money to begin with, then if that's the place you're making the choice without any new revenues, and then we made a choice to increase it here, it has to come from some other portion of the budget.
I guess what I'm getting at for the committee is, who is looking at the broad spectrum of how we support children at each level, and is that a consolidated, coordinated effort? So we're looking at early childhood, but then we need to look at, I'm just going to say K-12, and then we need to look at that assumes children are in school, mm-hmm. but then we need to look at 16 through 24. And is that coordinated? And are we asking the right questions for the right investments throughout their lifetime? So it's a rhetorical question.
Okay, Huffman?
I would say we're doing a much better job than we used to. We've worked on alignment from early learning through university a lot. It's been a big focus. I think a lot of the questions here are in line with, you know, a lot of other work that's been done from human services to education to this committee. So I think a lot of the right questions are being asked, and there is much better alignment today than there has been, if that helps.
And part of those conversations from a budget standpoint is what the education sub is having now. So the Department of Education, ODE, has a wide range of coverage in doing that, and so part of their job is to look at those types of things you talked about. The early learning, while we were reviewing the budget with ODE, is not, it's a separate program, and then you talked about the other one, the youth development. While they're separate to extent from a standpoint of a budget, all of those things are being reviewed at the same time, and so a lot of the questions members of that committee ask, it goes back to the policy discussion. So many of the questions have to do with policy, though they're not directly budgeting, but that's the reason they're asking them. Is somebody looking at the whole thing? And it's complex. It's very hard, and I think John's right. We're doing a better job of that, but it's still complex to be able to understand how it all fits. And unfortunately or fortunately, it's all, majority of it is around the general fund discussion. Other questions for David? Okay, great. You got off easy.
Oh, thank you.
So I'll close the informational hearing on the funding. Is there other questions in that people have that I would need to open up for information? So Doug can come up and speak about the budget, or are you satisfied at this point? You understand enough that we don't need to spend a 3 or 4 more hours on budget? We could, you know, if you'd like to.
But. Love to hear Doug talk, you know.
I figured you might.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Yes.
You know, in along the lines of questioning and alignment, it would be nice to get some information on the alignment between early learning and kindergarten readiness, and maybe a little more information about what that questioning period between the kindergarten teacher and the student looks like. Because, we were offered an article last week. Zena passed along, I think it was from Atlantic Magazine or The New Yorker or something. And very interesting article. So I'd like to hear more about what curricula-wise we're doing in early learning. Because when I got in the building 10 years ago, I used to assume that students were being prepared in high school for community college. And, you know, we through lots of questioning stuff, we found out that there needed to be more work and alignment done in that area. And then the same on the pathways for community colleges and prep. So, you know, I don't like to assume anything anymore that we are, you know, it'd be nice to know that policy end of it.
Sure.
Also.
Okay. Other questions, comments? So we're reaching the point that we'll be having to do more bill work along with our informational work. We went from having one or two bills to having quite a slew of bills we'll be considering. And again, in some cases, we're going to have the bill, we'll have the hearing, the discussions, but since they have a fiscal impact, we'll hold the bills until we get some, get further along in the session to decide, as most of you know, where the speaker, what direction she's given us on bills that have fiscals. Some of them we may indeed move down to Ways and Means and they'll sit there, for the others we may not, but it doesn't prevent us from having the hearings, because from my standpoint, we're preparing for the future as much as we're preparing for this time, so be prepared to do those. In specific, we've had the bills, but one particular bill referred to us on funding for family leave. Another topic, one obviously has a big impact on families and people, whether the early learning family supports. And so right now we're talking about scheduling that for the 23rd. And that, frankly, that hearing will take the whole, our whole amount of time in order to hear all the sides. There's multiple bills that have to do with paid family leave, but we'll be hearing one as the mechanism in which to have the conversation. And decide then after we've had that conversation what we that bill ultimately would have to be moved to revenue. So we wouldn't be the final decider, but whatever we might do. But that's coming up on the 23rd. So hold on. Anything else? Okay. We'll adjourn. Anything else?